Today is August the 25th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The FTC, that is the Federal Trade Commission, has refiled its antitrust lawsuit against Facebook. Amid a Facebook marketing blitz, the Federal Trade Commission refiled its antitrust lawsuit against the company, claiming that it holds monopoly power in the social media market and maintains that monopoly by systemically purchasing rivals and creating other barriers to competition. The refiled lawsuit is seen as the FTC's first major battle as it seeks to rein in the dominance of major tech companies that have come to dominate American life. It is also seen as a test of the agency's new chair, Lina Khan, who is a vocal critic of big tech in her work in academia and whom Facebook argued should recuse herself because of that work. Facebook is the world's dominant online social network, with a purported 3 billion plus regular users. Facebook has maintained its monopoly position in significant parts of pursuing Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg's strategy, expressed in 2008. It is better to buy than compete. The FTC complaint says, true to that maxim, Facebook has systemically tracked potential rivals and acquired companies that it viewed as serious competitive threats. Facebook supplemented this anti-competitive acquisition strategy with anti-competitive conditional dealing policies designed to erect or maintain entry barriers and to neutralize perceived competitive threats. The new filing describes schemes in which Facebook wielded its supremacy to undermine any potential for competition, not by out-innovating other companies, but by imposing contractual restrictions on developers that outright prohibited them from competing against Facebook. The outcome, impending the growth of emerging potential rivals in its industry to further its monopoly, is no different, the FTC said. Facebook simply paid its competition to disappear. Facebook continues to hold and operate the assets it acquires unlawfully and continues to keep them positioned to provide a protective moat around its personal social networking monopoly, the complaint said. A Facebook spokesperson said it was reviewing the FTC's amended complaint and would have more to say soon. Facebook lacked the business acumen and technical talent to survive the transition to mobile. After failing to compete with the new innovators, Facebook illegally bought or buried them when their popularity became an existential threat, said the acting director of the FTC's Bureau of Competition. This conduct is no less anti-competitive than if Facebook had bribed emerging app competitors not to compete. The antitrust laws were enacted to prevent precisely this type of illegal activity by monopolists. Facebook's actions have suppressed innovation and product quality improvements, and they have degraded the social network experience, subjecting users to lower levels of privacy and data protections, and more intrusive ads. The FTC's action today seeks to put an end to this illegal activity and restore competition for the benefit of Americans and honest businesses alike. The decision to file the complaint was approved in a 3-2 vote, with the agency's two Republican commissioners voting against the move. Facebook has until October 4th to respond to the complaint. News of the refiled lawsuit, which many onlookers expected, came amid a major PR push by the company, which included the announcement of a new transparency report about popular content on its platform and the launch of a virtual reality space in which users of its Oculus VR headsets can remotely attend meetings in digital form. In addition to Facebook, the company also owns Instagram and WhatsApp, two of the most widely used platforms worldwide, and are prime examples of the company using its vast resources to dominate the social media market. The FTC was forced to refile its historic lawsuit against Facebook after a federal judge tossed its original complaint in June, after agreeing with Facebook's motion to dismiss on the grounds that the government's suit failed to adequately support its claim that Facebook is, in fact, a monopoly. In a statement, Facebook refuted the FTC's assertion that it is a monopoly. Its response echoes the argument it made the first time the FTC filed the suit. It is unfortunate that despite the court's dismissal of the complaints and conclusion that it lacked a basis for a claim, the FTC had chosen to continue this meritless lawsuit, says Facebook. There was no valid claim that Facebook was monopolist, and that has not changed, the company said. Our acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp were reviewed and cleared many years ago, and our platform policies were lawful. The FTC's claims are an effort to rewrite antitrust laws and upend settled expectations of merger review, declaring to the business community that no sale is ever final. We fight to win people's time and attention every day, and we will continue vigorously defending our company. So this was a statement put out by Facebook, and from their point of view, they are not a monopoly. Although if you check the records, they've been averaging, in the past 4 or 5 years, they've been buying out a company every month. The Chinese firm behind the purchase of Britain's largest chip manufacturing facility has admitted that the acquisition could be blocked as the UK government reviews the takeover. Shanghai-headquartered WingTech Technologies warned shareholders that domestic and foreign industry policies present a risk to the takeover of Newport Wafer Fab, which is located in South Wales. The warning comes after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson ordered the UK's National Security Advisor to investigate the deal. WingTech acquired Newport Wafer Fab for around £63 million through a Dutch subsidiary it owns called Nexperia. The deal was announced in July and the terms of the agreement have now been confirmed, according to the WingTech statement filed to the Shanghai Stock Exchange. However, a spokesperson for the UK government said that deal is still being reviewed, saying we have considered this issue thoroughly and will continue to monitor the situation closely. WingTech is a listed manufacturing company that assembles smartphones and other consumer electronics. However, in the last few years, the company has become increasingly interested in semiconductors. With around 20,000 people on the staff and a market value of around $18 billion, it is one of the many companies in China to be backed by the Chinese government. Located on 28-acre site, Newport Wafer Fab employs around 400 people and produces around 8,000 wafers a week. The wafers are thin pieces of silicon that circuit patterns are printed on to build chips. The fab's 200-millimeter wafers are largely used in the automotive industry, which has been hit particularly hard by global chip shortage. A consortium is preparing to bid for Newport Wafer Fab if the government decides to block the deal. British lawmakers have raised concerns that the UK is selling off some of its most prized semiconductor companies to overseas buyers amid the global chip shortage. Semiconductors are today found in everything from missile systems to vacuum cleaners and toothbrushes. They're a critical component in today's technology-driven economies, and China has ambitions to be a world leader. The UK government is also in the process of deciding whether to approve the sale of Cambridge-based chip designer Arm, which is currently owned by SoftBank, to U.S. chip giant NVIDIA. Well, this chip shortage has now reached Toyota, who now has to cut their global production by 40%. Toyota had built up an inventory of semiconductor chips for any disruption in supply. New cars often include dozens of microchips, but Toyota benefited from having built a larger stockpile of chips as part of a revamp to its business continuity plan. Developed in the wake of the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami a decade ago. But they had not projected that such a chip shortage would last deep into the end of this year and beyond. Toyota is to slash worldwide vehicle production by 40% in September because of the global microchip shortage. The company will make some cuts in August at its plants in Japan and elsewhere. The bulk of the cuts, 360,000, will come in September and affect factories in Asia and the United States. In the United Kingdom, Toyota has a car plant at Burniston in Derbyshire and an engine plant on Deeside. In a statement, Toyota is going to great lengths to minimize the impact of the semiconductor supply shortage that is globally impacting the automotive industry. In terms of our UK production operations, they said, they are currently operating as planned at both plants. The aim of Toyota as a whole is to make up for any lost volume by the end of 2021. Toyota's other rivals, including General Motors, Ford, Nissan, Daimler, BMW, and Renault, have already scaled back production in the face of global chip shortage. Until now, Toyota had managed to avoid doing the same. With the exception of extending summer shutdowns by a week in France, the Czech Republic, and Turkey. The world's biggest car maker had planned to make almost 900,000 cars next month, but has now reduced that to 540,000 vehicles. Volkswagen, the world's second biggest car producer, has warned it may also be forced to cut output further. How the shortage is affecting firms? A wide range of businesses from car makers to small appliance manufacturers have been hit by the chip shortage. Renault forecasts its car production could be down by about 100,000 this year. Sony says it is difficult for it to bump up production of their PS5 consoles. Apple expects the impact of the shortage to worsen and extend the iPhone production. Tesla says it is using alternative chips and rewriting software. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing plans to build new factories in the United States and Japan. Issues started to emerge last year when Apple had to stagger the release of its iPhones, while the latest Xbox and PlayStation consoles failed to meet demand. Since then, one technology company after another has warned of the effects. And last month, the CEO of Intel, Pat Gelsinger, said the worst of the global chip crisis was yet to come. He predicted the shortage would get worse in the second half of this year, and it would be a year or two before supplies return to normal. The shortage prompted U.S. President Joe Biden to sign an executive order to address the issue. He vowed to seek $37 billion in funding for legislation to increase chip manufacturing in the United States. Microsoft announces price increases for Office 365 and Microsoft 365. The new pricing starts in March of 2022. You know, Microsoft has confused the masses with their product names. So let me restate for the sake of clarity what each is. Microsoft 365 is a cloud-based subscription service for home and business users that includes Office applications, cloud storage, and other features dependent on your plan. Whether you're an individual, a small mid-sized business, large enterprise, school, or not-for-profit, there's a plan for you. However, the Office 365 Home Edition is the suite of software you know as Word, Excel, PowerPoint, etc. Office 365 Business is a different product entirely. It is a suite of back-office servers that provide the types of functionality that used to require an in-house small business server. Microsoft is announcing its first price increases for its Office 365 and Microsoft 365 services in a decade. The price increases will affect commercial and business users of Microsoft software as a service offering next year, with no changes to pricing for education or consumers. Exchange Server, a line of messaging and collaborative software from Microsoft that is comprised of an email server, email client, and several groupware applications. The Microsoft Exchange line is prevalent in large corporations and is frequently used in conjunction with Microsoft Outlook. Exchange Server enables a company's users to securely access communications like email messages, voicemail, instant messaging, and SMS text messages from their desktops, web servers, or mobile devices. OneDrive, a cloud-based file storage mechanism that synchronizes a folder on your computer with a folder in the Microsoft Data Center, an effective way to keep data in sync between multiple personal computers and have that data always available online. And then there's SharePoint, which is a web-based file sharing and process automation utility with advanced document management facilities like checkout, check-in to keep track of who makes modifications to a file, and revision control to be able to compare and revisit, restore older versions of files. Web-based versions of Word, Excel, Outlook, etc. And there's several secondary tools like Microsoft Teams, a group chat application, and Sway, an online presentation tool akin to PowerPoint. Well, now that I've got through that, let's go back to Microsoft's updated pricing that will go into effect next March. Microsoft 365 Business Basic will go from $5 to $6 per user per month. Microsoft 365 Business Premium will go up from $20 to $22 a month per user. Office 365 E1 will go up from $8 to $10. Office 365 E3 will go from $20 to $23. Office 365 E5 will go up from $35 to $38. And Microsoft 365 E3 from $32 to $36. Microsoft first launched Office 365 in 2011 across 40 different markets, and the company has been improving it since. These prices changes mark the first substantive pricing update since they launched Office 365 a decade ago. They also come as Microsoft has reported a record year of revenue growth thanks to cloud services like Office 365. Microsoft has more than 300 million paid seats for Office 365, so the price changes will certainly bump Microsoft's profit and revenue even further next year. By the way, price increase was not due to operating expenses. It was due to increasing profits. Intel has a source chip strategy partnership with Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. Intel Corporation gave new details of its turnaround strategy to source subcomponents of its chips from external factories, including new specifics of partnerships with rival Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company. Intel is one of the few remaining semiconductor firms that still designs and manufactures its own chips, but it lost its lead in making the fastest chips to Taiwan Semiconductor, which focuses on manufacturing designs from outside firms after missteps in its manufacturing operations. Intel Chief Executive Pat Gelsinger earlier this year outlined the company's strategy to regain its footing in manufacturing by the year 2025. But in the meantime, Intel is trying to prevent further erosion of its chip market share by rivals such as Advanced Micro Devices and NVIDIA Corporation, who have faster offerings. Part of Intel's answer involves tapping rivals like Taiwan Semiconductor for subcomponents of chips called tiles and stitching those together in Intel's own factories with packaging technology. Intel said its new Ponte Vecchio chip will use key tiles made with Taiwan Manufacturing's N5 and N7 chipmaking technologies placed on top of an Intel-made base. The Ponte Vecchio chip's first major use will be in a supercomputer that Intel is building for the United States Department of Energy. A senior vice president of Intel's Accelerated Computing Systems and Graphics Group conceded that it had been years since Intel challenged NVIDIA at speeding up artificial intelligence software, a market that has powered much of the chips industry's expansion in recent years. He said the Ponte Vecchio chip is faster than NVIDIA's offering at some of those tasks. For a decade, we just let them have free rein. That ends now. Intel earlier also gave a new name to its graphics chips that would challenge NVIDIA's other major markets of video gaming. Intel said its Alchemist graphics chip will be made by Taiwan Semiconductor using the latter's newly named N6 chipmaking technology, an upgraded version of its N7 technology. Intel's graphic chip will tap new versions of Taiwan Semiconductor 7nm process source, and Intel would use Taiwan Semiconductor's upgraded technology. It's amazing how rivals can be friends. The latest T-Mobile data breach affects over 40 million people. The names, social security numbers, and information from driver's licenses or other identification of just over 40 million people who applied for T-Mobile credit were exposed in a recent data breach. The same data for about 7.8 million current T-Mobile customers who pay monthly for phone service also appears to be compromised. No phone numbers, account numbers, PINs, passwords, or financial information from the nearly 50 million records and accounts were compromised. T-Mobile has been hit before by data theft, but in most recent case, the sheer numbers far exceed the previous breaches. T-Mobile, which is based in Bellevue, Washington, became one of the country's largest cell phone service carriers, along with AT&T and Verizon, after buying rival Sprint last year. It reported to have a total of 102.1 million U.S. customers after the merger. T-Mobile also confirmed that approximately 850,000 active T-Mobile prepaid customer names, phone numbers, and account PINs were exposed. The company said that it proactively reset all of the PINs on those accounts. No Metro by T-Mobile, former Sprint prepaid, or Boost customers had their names or PINs exposed. There was also some additional information from inactive prepaid accounts accessed through prepaid billing files. T-Mobile said that no customer financial information, credit card information, debit or other payment information, or social security numbers were in the inactive file. T-Mobile had said earlier that it was investigating a leak of its data after someone took to an online forum offering to sell the personal information of cell phone users hit. The company said this past Monday that it had confirmed that there was unauthorized access to some T-Mobile data and that it had closed the entry point used to gain access. If you were affected, you'll hear from them soon, said CEO of T-Mobile. The company now says it will immediately offer 2 years of free identity protection services and is recommending that all of its postpaid customers, those who pay in monthly installments, change their PINs. Its investigation is ongoing. T-Mobile has previously disclosed a number of data breaches over the years, most recently in January and before that in November of 2019, and before that in August of 2018, all of which involve unauthorized access to customer information. It also disclosed a breach affecting its own employees' email accounts in 2020, and in 2015, hackers stole personal information belonging to about 15 million T-Mobile wireless customers and potential customers in the United States, which they obtained from credit reporting agency Experian. Ultimately, T-Mobile has had a lot of really sensitive information on people, and it's just a matter of luck. This time, the information affected was not financial information. The hack didn't appear particularly sophisticated and involved a configuration issue on a server used for testing T-Mobile phones. There was a gate left wide open for the attackers, and they just had to find the gate and walk through it. And T-Mobile didn't know about the attack until the attackers posted about it in an online forum. Let me give you a translation of that. T-Mobile did not even know that there had been a data theft. That is scary. Taiwan Semiconductor to ship pieces of its new U.S. plant via cargo freight. With the recent tensions in geopolitics, China has issued a new threat to the United States amid soaring tensions over its relations with Taiwan. Taiwan Semiconductor is a Taiwanese company. Apple, AMD, Intel, Qualcomm, NVIDIA, and Broadcom are among its major customers, making up the vast majority bulk of their revenues. If China were to carry out their threat to take over Taiwan, the major supply of semiconductor chips to the world would disrupt the economy of the United States as well as the rest of the world. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing is shipping manufacturing facilities, including a clean room, via cargo freight to the United States in order to lower costs associated with setting up a new plant in the United States. It is estimated that 4,000 to 5,000 containers will be used, with the total transportation cost coming to roughly $110 million, and the first batch of equipment is expected to leave the port in October. Sources say the plan has already been approved and set in motion by Taiwan Semiconductor's chairperson and Taiwanese shipping firm Evergreen Marine Corporation. Han Tang, Taiwan's largest clean room engineering firm, is also involved. Considering the current surge in demand for cargo shipping worldwide and the strategic importance of Taiwan Semiconductor's Arizona plan for Taiwan-U.S. relations. Yang Ming's Marine Transport Corporation, which is 48% state-owned, may be the safest partner to ensure shipping is carried out smoothly. Taiwan Semiconductor requires a lot of space to ship all the required parts. Several companies may be involved. Evergreen Shipping, which has the largest capacity among Taiwan's top three container carriers, is likely to play a major role. When you think about it, for security, moving the entire plant to the United States makes a whole lot of sense with all that sword rattling that's going on. Who is Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company? A profile of a company that missed their mark in the semiconductor design industry, but is now big time in the manufacturing of the semiconductors. This is the tale of the revolutionary chip maker, Taiwan Semiconductor. How a company with revenues of $36 billion in 2019, with a staff of 51,000 employees, is now in the center of the technology business. The original giant of Taiwan's tech scene created the conditions for today's $500 billion semiconductor industry. The computer chips made by the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company aren't just the brains inside smartphones, laptops, and video game consoles. They're also core components of almost every kind of electronic equipment in the world, from that used in data centers to F-35 fighter jets, and Apple, Huawei, Sony, Qualcomm, Broadcom, and HiSilicon are all clients, along with nearly 500 others. Wherever in the world it is, Taiwan Semiconductor is a significant part of the supply chain. Taiwan Semiconductor fundamentally shaped the semiconductor industry, which makes tiny slivers of silicon into the computer chips inside the electronic devices. Many leading companies like Huawei and Apple design, but don't actually manufacture their own chips. Unlike integrated device manufacturers such as Intel and Samsung, which design and then make the chips used in their own products, Taiwan Semiconductor's model is that of a dedicated, pure-play foundry. It only operates on a contract basis, and it doesn't sell devices of its own design. In their business-to-business model, companies can even design the tools that Taiwan Semiconductor will use when making their chips. Over the past three decades, Taiwan Semiconductor has invested in 18 state-of-the-art chip-making facilities called FABs, for Fabrication Facility, in Taiwan. Today, the firm accounts for more than half of the $42 billion foundry segment of the semiconductor industry. Taiwan Semiconductor is an absolute critical supply in those companies who want to get the most advanced chips available. There is no one else who has the capacity as a foundry to deliver the volumes and capabilities that those companies are asking for. While companies like Apple and Samsung have built their business on instantly recognizable designs, it's the hidden brains inside the device that ultimately determines its true capabilities. And inside all of them are microchips, bits of cobalt, and copper fused onto a charged silicon wafer. Morris Chang, who founded Taiwan Semiconductor in 1987, has been called the godfather of the computer chip manufacturing business. He spent 25 years working at Texas Instruments, developing its semiconductor business. By the time former premier of Taiwan recruited Chang to move to Taiwan and lead a government-backed technology development project, the semiconductor industry was extremely competitive, and Taiwan didn't have many advantages. Chang said he already knew how tough it would be to carve out a new niche. At the time, Taiwan had few strengths in research and development, intellectual property, circuit design, or marketing. The only possible strength that Taiwan had, and even that was a potential one, not an obvious one, was semiconductor manufacturing, wafer manufacturing, he recalled. And so what kind of company would you create to fill that strength and avoid all the other weaknesses? The answer is pure play foundry. With the foundry model, Chang thought the country could lean on its manufacturing potential, though most leading firms back in 1980, like Intel, NEC, Fujitsu, designed and made the chips used in their own devices, Taiwan Semiconductor paved the way for a future where those companies could design their chips and contract their production out, saving the enormous investment of time and capital required to keep up their own fabs. The foundry business model has enabled the emergence of the fabless industry by eliminating the financial burden associated with semiconductor manufacturing. A Taiwan Semiconductor spokesperson said it allows efficient vertical specialization and democratizes the innovation process, resulting in greater product diversity and faster innovation at lower cost. Basically, new companies that want chips for their ideas no longer have to invest in their own foundries or rely on their competitors to produce them. This opened up the market for fabless semiconductor industry, put Taiwan Semiconductor in the position of making essential components for top tech companies in Silicon Valley and Beijing alike. And in a recent post about Taiwan Semiconductor's geopolitical relevance, it was stated that today there are thousands of chip designers in all kinds of niches creating specialized chips for everything from appliances to fighter jets, and none of them have their own foundry. Up until recently, Taiwan Semiconductor mostly played a background role as a supplier of the processors inside the signature devices of top brands like Apple and Huawei. But Washington and Beijing attempt to disentangle their supply chains have now made this a sticking point. Taiwan Semiconductor importance to major Chinese and American companies over the past 30 years have raised Taiwan's profile as a center of high-tech manufacturing. But Taiwan's position as an earthquake-prone island that is not recognized as a nation by most others make it a precarious location for a nerve center of global microchip manufacturing. Last year, Chang told a crowd at a company event that Taiwan Semiconductor was gaining vital importance in geostrategic terms. After successfully becoming an essential link in hundreds of supply chains on both sides of the Pacific, Taiwan Semiconductor remains light years ahead of other chip makers. This year, Taiwan Semiconductor started mass production of 5-nanometer chips, beating out competitors like Shanghai Semiconductor Manufacturing International, that's SMIC, which is still making 14-nanometer chips. But because of the trade war between the United States and China, Taiwan Semiconductor faces the prospect of losing one of its biggest customers, Huawei. The Chinese telecom giant relies on Taiwan Semiconductor-made chips for everything from network processors to smartphones to 5G base stations, and U.S. regulators want Taiwan Semiconductors to cut ties. Now that Taiwan Semiconductor has stopped taking new orders from Huawei, the company is left to source more chips from SMIC, which already makes parts for some of its gear. Though the vast majority of their production has always taken place in their 18 fabs in Taiwan, Taiwan Semiconductor operates two fabs in China and an older subsidiary facility in Washington State. In May, the company announced plans to build a fab in Arizona. By the way, one of the biggest customers of Taiwan Semiconductor is AMD. And with AMD's design, Taiwan Semiconductor makes more money than AMD in just designing the chip. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell, Company Mergers and IT.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time to talk about IT and the workplace. And I was in a conversation recently in regards to company mergers. And yeah, we may have seen less company mergers in the recent year just because things have been in a little state of flux. But I think we're going to start seeing more mergers. We're going to see different adjustments in how companies are interacting. And one of the directions that this conversation went was this person was asking me a number of different questions in my background, because I have been working for a company that was purchased by a venture capital firm that had five other companies very similar to ours. We had our niche areas. We had our specialty areas within the aerospace industry. So I'm going to kind of approach this not so much from the aerospace industry, but just what I experienced when we had this merger, essentially purchased by a solitary owner and moving into a corporate world. One of the first things we had to look at was the integration of the IT staff as well as the various infrastructure resources that were available across the board. We were all individual entities at that point when we were acquired. They were all individual entities and stayed that way for about a year. And then somebody said, we need to get all onto the same software platform. And that involved getting somebody involved who was familiar with all of the different software packages that were available amongst our companies. My company, the one that was purchased, was running a DOS-level program some 20 years, well, not 20 years, 15 years, after DOS had pretty much gone the way of the dodo bird. And so we were chosen. My particular location was chosen to be the first to go on to this new software package. I enjoyed it. I was longing for that. I'd worked for the company for 5 years and was actually looking for an exit because it was getting pretty bad that we were relying on this DOS program. But we had to integrate all of this together. We had to integrate some of the different ways of doing things. Some of the different ways of the different practices of reporting numbers and things like that. And along with that, there were many different aspects that came along through this. We added on a wide area network technician who started to plan out how we would all communicate through a common email system, a common network, how we would have common access across the board. And we shared this information back and forth. But one of the inevitable things, of course, that comes along with this is that sometimes some of these companies need to reduce the IT departments. Sometimes, yes, we had a number of different people that worked for us in IT, and some of those roles were somewhat redundant. And yeah, we unfortunately had to address that. We had a few different locations which had too many people and other locations which didn't have enough people. But we put it all together. We figured it out. But one of the things that also became troublesome was that we had staffers that had to remain on board and stick around. See, that's the problem that you've got. When you merge companies, some of the brain trust that sits around, some of that tribal knowledge of how things have been done needs to be held on to. So yeah, there were different approaches. There were different people at different pay levels that also had to be addressed. You know, word travels fast. Hey, you get paid that much? Really? You're the same kind of tech as I am. Yeah, but I'm in the Los Angeles market. And that's just an example conversation. Not always happening in all of the companies, but you've got to be aware of this. So there were a number of different directions that this conversation went in. I will tell you that in the end, we managed to put a lot together. And I would say that for the most part, everything that I had feared going into the merger was the fears were allayed and a lot of the promises were made good on. We improved the technology. And you're going to find whenever you get a bunch of nerds together that they're going to have a common thread of improving everything. Hey, I've got this idea. This is what we did over here. Oh, hey, and I got this idea. This is what we did over here. Hey, what if we all did this? And we managed to improve the IT infrastructure. We managed to improve the IT policies. We managed to improve a lot of the different things that we were doing across the board. When you have that commonality, especially when you have people who have niche strengths, you get to have multiple people coming along together alongside of each other and improving the whole IT infrastructure. Yeah, again, I admit that we did have a couple of people that were, I'll say, dead weight. That's not a nice term, but I think they knew it. They had not progressed with their knowledge. They had not progressed with their experience, and that kind of held them back. It held the company back. People who stay in the past, who want to use the old DOS software, yeah, they're not going to survive. People who want to take on the new software, they're going to do much better. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Unplug these appliances that hike up your electricity bill. A popular topic today is cord cutting. There is another related computing cost that is mostly under the radar. That is the electrical usage to power all that computing equipment you have in the home. If you have ever opened your electric bill only to be shocked by the amount owed, you'll likely also wonder exactly what you can do to save money on utilities beyond turning off lights as you leave a room. Figuring out how to reduce your electric bill can be as simple as figuring out what's costing you the most. To do this, you can follow a simple formula to determine how many kilowatt hours a device is using in a month or year, and then find ways to cut back where possible. Kilowatt hours are essentially a way of measuring how much power a device uses in an hour of being turned on. If you look at most appliances, they will supply a wattage or a range of wattages the device operates at, how many watts it turns in an hour. Once you have the wattage, simply divide that by 1,000 to convert the watts to kilowatts, and then multiply by how many hours a day you use the item. That will give you a basic figure for how many kilowatt hours a day you're using with that item. From that, you can use the U.S. Department of Energy number for the average U.S. utility rate of 12 cents per kilowatt hours. Of course, if you're in the Northeast, like in the New York City regional area, it's like double and triple that number. Or you can get more specific and get your rates straight from your energy provider. Based on what your costs are, you can then determine which appliance or device is the actual energy vampire and what's not really using much electricity. And by the way, there's a term that's being used. It's called random energy suckers. There are certain devices that still suck power even after they're turned off, and that's a major issue. You need to be aware of how many are actually continuing to draw power even when they're not on, including devices like your computer, instant-on TVs, surround sound systems, or even cable and satellite TV boxes. For that matter, anything with a built-in digital clock is pulling a little juice. The National Resources Defense Council estimates that almost a quarter of the energy used by your home is consumed by idle devices that aren't even on. That's high rate. In other words, one-fourth of your electrical bill are things that just sits idle. It's estimated that the average household in Northern California spends between $210 to $440 a year on energy vampires, and the country as a whole spends $19 billion a year for electricity it's not really using. How do you deliver the proverbial wooden stake to the heart of your energy vampires? Unplug the things you aren't using. Use power strips for devices you know use power while idle. Adjust power settings on things like your computer or TV, and consider getting timers for outlets to help control usage. You're not sure which devices are adding the biggest idle load to your energy bill? Well, here are some of the items that you could check. The set-top box. Average wattage is 16 to 57 watts. The cost per year, $16 to $57 a year. Many homes have multiple set-top boxes, which leads to a bigger energy suck. Consider unplugging boxes that aren't used regularly, such as a box in the guest bedroom. For the boxes used regularly, consider plugging in the entire entertainment system, that is the set-top box, TV speakers, and other items, into a power strip so that the whole thing can be turned off at once. Well, there's also your audio-visual equipment. Average wattage, 7 to 40 watts. Cost per year, $7 to $40. Audio devices like amplifiers, stereos, boomboxes, internet radio receivers are easy enough to unplug when not in use. This simple act can save you up to $40 a year. Along the same line, all those home assistants, whether or not it's from Alexa or it's from Google, well, for each device you have, it's $7 to $40 a year for each individual unit. Then you have your television. The average wattage is 2 to 54 watts. Of course, the size of the TV matters. Use the high-end number, $54. Unplug any TVs that you don't regularly use, such as the one in the guest bedroom. You should also adjust the power setting on your TV. Consider disabling the TV's quick start setting to save on energy. Now we get to the good stuff, the desktop computer. If you happen to have a desktop computer, it can be as low as 1 to 49 watts, and the cost per year is $1 to $49. Your computer doesn't draw a ton of power, even when it's on, with a typical desktop costing you about a penny an hour. However, even pennies can add up. You know, as what Ben Franklin says, a penny here and a penny there, well, it's a penny earned. And over the course of a year, all these pennies add up. Plug your computer, monitor, printer, computer speakers, and other computer accessories into a single power strip that can be turned off when not in use. Let your computer go to sleep after a maximum of 30 minutes of inactivity, and turn your computer off whenever you're finished using it. By the way, there's a comment I like to make on that. I have my power set on balance. In other words, after 15 minutes or 20 minutes of idle time on the screen or on the drive, it gets turned off. But lately, with all these Zoom meetings, so that the power doesn't get turned off on me while someone is talking at great length, I have the power on, never turn off. I got to remember to set that each time. Well, you also have the modem. The average wattage is 5 to 17 watts. Cost per year, $5 to $17. Unplug your modem before going to bed. You don't need internet access when you're asleep. And then you got your telephone charges. They use an average of 2 to 6 watts. The cost per year, 2 to 6 watts. Now, 2 to 6 watts drawn while charging your phone seem hardly worth mentioning, but it's the power your charges draw while it isn't juicing up your phone that makes this device stand out. Leaving that charger plugged into an outlet all day still uses 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.3 up to 0.5 watts per hour. That's also not a lot, but in this case, every little bit adds up. It's pure waste. If you have a charger at home that's plugged in 24/7, you're costing yourself up to 44 cents in electricity. Then the laptop computer. Average wattage is about 25 watts. Cost per year, about $26. Most laptop cords have a brick, a large brick that uses energy continuously whenever it's plugged in. This means that simply shutting your laptop or turning it off will not stop it from using energy. Unplug the cord from the wall every time you're not using your laptop to ensure it's not draining energy you aren't even using. And for those who may have a video game system at home, the average wattage is 36 watts. Cost per year, $36. Video game consoles are another common energy vampire. These devices often remain connected to the network even when they are not in use and are set to be in a default instant-on mode, a mode that was disabled in Europe due to the European Union's standby energy standards. Unplug your game consoles when not in use and disable the instant-on mode if you don't need it. And how many of you have a laser printer at home? Average wattage is 250 watts. Cost per hour, 3 cents. That may not sound like a lot, but multiply that cost per hour of 3 cents over 24 hours, well, it comes out to a little bit under a buck a day. But, gee, now wait a minute now. You got 30 days in a year. You have 30 days in a month. That's $30. Your laser printer is probably in standby mode more than it's actually in use. So it can be easy to overlook this energy vampire. The average laser printer uses 70 kilowatt hours annually while in standby mode, which would amount to about $8 annually. That's $8 you could save by simply unplugging a printer when you're not using it. So when you add up a dollar here, a dollar there, this may or may not be the equal of what you can save by cord cutting. In fact, I know that with cord cutting, with all the a la carte options, some people end up paying the same amount of money whether they had a set-top box with a cable operator or they're viewing streaming television on the internet. Oh, by the way, let me remind everyone that for those who are green conscious and plan on buying an electric car, the electric car may save you on gasoline, but there's an electrical bill that goes with it. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, August the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and the topic of presentation is privacy, from intelligent audio to humanoid robots. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, bcug.com for meeting ID information. Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, September the 2nd at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Contact wpcug.org for meeting ID information. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 3rd. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Contact acgnj.org for meeting ID information. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.